Hi, my name is Christina Phillips. I'm a producer for The Exchange at New Hampshire Public Radio. And this is a great program, I think, for people who think they know everything about the state and people who don't know anything about the state. I feel like every week we talk about topics that you may know a lot about, or you might learn something completely new, but every time you're getting to hear from experts, people who care a lot about these issues, people who maybe have not gotten to have their voice on the radio before. It's a great way to learn a lot of things about what makes our state tick and what's important to people around the state. And so if you use this service, if you subscribe to the podcast and you think it's an important part of your life, you should definitely try to support that, whether it's $5, $10, or even $20. Giving is really easy to do. You just go to nhpr.org, or you can follow the link right there in the show notes. And thanks.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm KJ Delantonia, sitting in for Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. What are your kids reading this summer? Are they reading at all? For book-loving adults, summer means light reads in a beach chair at every opportunity. But many kids, even with plenty of time at their disposal, aren't voluntarily choosing books over other options. That worries parents, because reading is one of the best ways to stay ready for school in the fall. If your child isn't happy to pick up a book, what can you do to encourage them? And what books are kids and teens loving this year? Today on The Exchange, Summer Reading for Kids. Join the conversation. Send us your thoughts, strategies, and book recommendations. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So with me in the studio today are Michael Sullivan. He is the library director at the Ware Public Library and the author of Connecting Boys with Books and Raising Boy Readers. Michael, thank you for coming.
Well, thanks for having me.
We are also joined by Erin Moulton. She is the young adult librarian at the Derry Public Library and the author of several young adult novels, Flutter, Tracing Stars, Chasing the Milky Way, and Keepers of the Labyrinth. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And we also have Elizabeth Ellis. She is a former language arts teacher who worked most recently as a reading interventionist at Timberlane Middle School. And she's going to be starting as the new librarian at Timberlane Middle School in the fall of this year.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, guys, thanks for coming. I'm so excited about this conversation. I think it's going to be really fun. We're going to talk about reading and books for kids and teenagers. And later in the hour, we're going to try for some great book recommendations. But I wanted to start with the basics. Why should we be concerned about our children reading over the summer? I mean, should we even be concerned, or should we just give kids who aren't particularly interested in books a break? And Elizabeth, I wanted to start with you.
Oh, I definitely think they need to be reading over the summer. We call that the summer slide when
right.
they lose those skills. So important to reading, visualization, inferencing, predicting, and just the enjoyment of reading.
So if the more kids read over the summer, is that going to help them be ready for school when it comes back to coming around in the fall?
I believe so.
I've seen some research that suggests kids lose more ground in math than reading. You know, should we be pushing them both, or can we focus on the reading for summertime?
Well, we definitely need to be focusing on the reading for the simple fact that reading is how kids learn everything else. Kids will be better at math if they're better at reading. And, you know, every math teacher needs to know that. Every history teacher needs to know. Kids will learn more by reading than they'll ever be taught in any subject.
So do you see age differences and how much focus we should put on this? Is it different for kids who are just learning to read and early readers or middle graders and teens? I'm going to come back to you for that, Michael.
We definitely have to deal with kids differently at different ages, but there is one overriding concern that we can deal with in the summer, and that is reading needs to be done in volume, which means it needs to be done for pleasure. And this is one of the real differences in the summer, is that we get a chance now to let kids read in a way that's comfortable, it's a way that gives them choice. So no matter how old your kid is, pretty much assume during the summer they're going to read years below their grade level or their developmental level, which means if you read to your three-year-old all year and your six-year-old is home for the summer, you should be reading to your six-year-old as if you were a three-year-old. And if you have a 15-year-old, don't be surprised if your 15-year-old is reading at a 12-year-old's level. That's perfectly fine.
What if the school has you know, created some reading requirements for the summer? Any thoughts? Is that a good thing? Erin, go ahead.
We have Pinkerton in our district does do a summer reading list for their freshman and sophomore. Mm-hmm. It's only one book though that they have to choose. So there's
a really
plenty.
I see a list, and they choose from
they
one.
They choose, yeah. They get to choose out of that list what they want to read, and then there's plenty of time beyond that to read for pleasure.
Right, Elizabeth. Does your school have a reading requirement over the summer that you're aware of?
Yes, they do. All three grades, incoming sixth graders, seventh and seventh graders do. Eighth graders also who are going into high school have a different summer reading. But the ones who are coming into the middle school have a list of books they can choose from, but they don't have to choose one of those books. The teachers and librarians do book talks to the classes, and then they can choose one of those books or anything they want. And there's also a project that has to go along with it. Again, choice. Things like making a movie, a book talk, a summary. So really it's all about choice in getting the kids to read.
Michael, I thought I saw sort of a dubious look on your face at the idea that schools would impose a requirement over the summer.
And I know a lot of them do. And there's plenty of good reason, too. Here's the counterargument, and that is not everybody reads the same types of things, likes to read the same types of things. And the books that get on reading lists often come from a fairly narrow type of reading that we recognize as, and unfortunately comes across as, real reading. There's some fantastic books, and there's some books that every kid really should be exposed to, but chances are, if you try and pick one book, you're going to lose an awful lot of kids. And so the more choice, the better. And there's a researcher named William Brazzo who did the best work on this and really found that almost universally, the kids that read well talk about their reading as if they have control of it. And the kids that don't read up to their grade level universally talk about reading being thrust upon them. You don't want to be on the wrong side of that equation.
Well, it's a tough equation to sit on, though, because as a parent, if there isn't a reading requirement and you have a child who isn't just going to gravitate towards reading, I think you're sort of walking that, I want the kids to read. I don't want to force them to read. I want the kids to read. Maybe I do want to force them to read. Right. It's a tough one. Erin, what do you think?
Well, I mean, libraries are great for that because public libraries do the collaborative library summer reading programs. And we challenge the kids to do reading. And it's based entirely on their own interests. So this year we're doing a reading challenge that's a bingo. And they get to select there's a lot of different categories, pick a mystery, pick a thriller, pick a graphic novel, pick a nonfiction book. And they read whatever they want that's in those genres. Once they get a bingo, they then can pick gifts that are at my desk. And this year I'm totally bribing them. I've got ThinkGeek gift cards, Starbucks gift cards. I've got GameStop gift cards. I've got a lot of swag. So once they drop one of those off, they can come get a gift card. And then they also get into a raffle, and I have some great sponsors this year, including Granite State Escape Room and Canobie Lake Park. So
that
they could potentially
great.
Do one of those things
right.
if they get picked for the raffle.
Yeah.
So
I mean,
I'm not above bribery. You could bring your kids in, have them sign up for the challenge, and it's good.
Well, actually, I want to come back to bribery and incentives in a minute, but I have an email. We have an email from Crystal. This is about choice in reading. She says, I'm a public high school teacher in New Hampshire and have been for 10 years. From 5 years ago, I started incorporating choice reading into the first 10 minutes of all of my classes, inspired by some of Penny Kittle's work at Kennett. My students can read anything they want, as long as it's a novel. I provide suggestions, talk about books every day, and regularly discuss what I've been reading. When they finish a novel, they put a link on a paper chain and move on to the next. That's it. I find that most of my students are drawn to gritty, realistic fiction. Winger by Andrew Smith has been a constant favorite that's been constantly replaced. While a handful of my students are regular readers, many do not read for pleasure outside of these 10 minutes in class, which makes these minutes the most sacred of my instruction. When most students enter my class, they admit that they have faked almost all of their assigned reading to that point, relying on Google and Spark Notes for their grades. Many haven't read a book before, ever. Ugh. Since incorporating choice reading, my students have read thousands of books and have been more willing to engage and work through our more difficult assigned books. Some still fake, but through their choice reading, most have developed the stamina to work with harder texts. Wow, never read a book all the way ever. Thank you, Spark Notes. That's, yeah, a little horrifying. So choice in reading. You mentioned, I think, Elizabeth, that your school's program is pretty choicey as well, right?
It is. The summer reading is, I mean, they do have a list. And they also did a really good job of having books for kids at all levels. Mm-hmm. You know, your more struggling or developing readers to your proficient higher level readers. So choice, yeah.
I'm torn between going to bribes and incentives and going to gender and choice, because I think that can get really interesting. Let's go with the gender. So when book lists, I can remember as a student that the book lists we would be offered in high school were very, very male-centric. Mm-hmm. Now it almost feels like they're often kind of girl-centric. Michael, are there differences in the books that we maybe should be encouraging or presenting to boys and girls?
Well, we certainly should be presenting a lot of different types of books to everyone. There are certainly some trends that are more pronounced with boys and more pronounced with girls, but there's always crossover. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about gendered reading, what you're really talking about is a reading approach that has a bigger effect on more of one, but really can help another. And it actually ties into the email that you got, because you got someone who cares a ton, who's done their research and has come up with a wonderful idea, and then has one unconscious bias in there.
Oh, tell us.
Anything they want as long as it's a novel.
Mm.
One of the gender differences is that boys do tend to enjoy nonfiction reading more than girls, and very often more than fiction reading. But we have this belief that strong reading requires reading long-form fiction. And that really is an unconscious bias that really works against us. There was a researcher in Canada named Roy Doron who did this research over several years, 10,000 choices of kids just going to a classroom library and picking a book. And boys chose 3 nonfiction books for every 4 fiction books. Almost half their reading in free reading time was nonfiction. And then he added up the books in the classroom libraries, and they were 85% fiction. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they were finding nonfiction even though there was virtually none to choose from. And there's really no research that says that reading attainment is better when you read fiction or nonfiction or long form or short form or on a tablet or in a book or in a magazine as opposed to a book. That's the biggest thing when it comes to gender, is that we naturally have a picture of what reading is, and there's a different point of view that we don't always see, because let's face it, 91% of our elementary school teachers in America are female.
Are women, yes. That's kind of the way it's worked. Elizabeth, I know you're just getting into the library at Timberlake, but do you have a pretty good nonfiction to fiction selection? Do you see the same sort of thing with the boys gearing towards the nonfiction?
Well, I can speak for my classroom.
Right.
Yes, definitely. I have students who like war books, biographies, so I would agree.
What kinds of nonfiction are you seeing, Erin, that that boys and girls, both, I guess, are going towards in the library?
I actually was thinking I have a lot of boys who love series fantasy.
Mm.
So that's what I tend to see. But when I'm giving any sort of recommendation, Michael was talking about choice, and I always think about how do they then choose when they're in the library, right? There are a lot of books. And there are a lot of books in the teen space. So helping any teen choose, I have to know what they like to read.
Right.
And I basically do a reference interview. I want to know what they read last that they loved, what they read last that they didn't like. If they're not reading at all, what game are they loving?
Mm.
What movie do they love? What are their favorite genres? And then I can narrow in on what book they might appreciate.
Because that, that when in fiction, that fantasy, not fantasy divide, that tends, I think, to be pretty clear.
Oh, yeah.
Like
absolutely.
Some kids just are like...
Absolutely not going to go
even
there.
Even Harry Potter doesn't work for some kids.
But the ones who love fantasy will read fantasy. They go walking out with a stack of books like...
Well, how about books like, you know, the Guinness Book of World Records from 2015? I see kids poring over that.
Among the most popular, we actually have a display in my library in the teen section of... just what we just call big books, and it's a double meaning because they're not only are those things physically huge, but they are big topic, big look at all sorts of different types of things. Anything from Guinness Books of World Records to Ripley's Believe It or Not to all of these what we call encyclopedic nonfiction. And that's certainly one trend. The other trend really is narrative nonfiction. The stuff that's often written by journalists, things like Swanson's Chasing Lincoln's Killer was so popular for a while. It's nonfiction that reads like fiction and appeals to a type of kid that often gets overlooked when you're looking at just the divide between the two. So you've got to have a huge spectrum.
I guess when I think about those reading requirements for school that say, you know, if you read 10 books over the summer, you get an A. If you read 8 books, you read, then the Guinness Book of World Records is a little hard to fit into that. That's a tough one. I guess that's maybe why, like I said, you get this dubious look every time I bring up the required reading.
Yes. And it's one of those things. Nobody who makes those rules is trying to hurt any kid. They just don't necessarily realize that a kid could spend 30 hours reading that book. And ultimately, and this is what really summer reading comes down to, is once you learn to read independently, the only true predictor of how well you are going to develop as a reader is how much time you spend doing it. It's the amount of time you spend staring at text. Just like before you become a reader, the only thing that really makes a difference is how many words you hear. Summer reading, you got to open that up. And, you know, we play around, especially with librarians, we're always arguing about this, you know, what's the best approach? And the best approach really is to be as flexible as possible so that kids can spend time reading things that speak to them.
Well, this is why some researchers call reading sort of the only thing that is worth bribing kids to do, because it is... Reading success can be about sheer volume of time spent reading, whether you're doing it voluntarily or not. Then this is, it's one perspective. There's a survey I've seen, 60% of British parents admit to offering some form of incentive, which you can also call a bribe, to their kids for reading. And I know, Aaron, you're incentivizing all over the place at the library. Should we distinguish between parents doing it and libraries? Should we do it at all?
That's a good question. I don't give an incentive for my son to read or sitting down with my son to read at all. But I do the summer reading with him at the library. So it's not coming from mom. It's coming from the library.
So
it sustains it over the summer, right? And then they jump back into school.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm going to want to come back to this question of bribery. So give this a little bit of thought, Michael and Elizabeth, because it's out there. And I guess before we get into the break, really quickly, does the middle school do anything sort of to reward students for reading over the summer?
Nope.
Michael, are you guys, does your library offer an incentive program?
Absolutely. And I think there's a distinction to be made between forcing a kid to read and bribing him to read. I have no problem with the word bribing, by the way. That's perfectly fine with me. It's an entirely different approach because, again, it's agency, and the kid needs the agency. If he decides to go for the bribe, that's his choice, and that's the way to go.
I guess that's kind of a tough question if you've got reading requirements to be met and you really want your kids to be reading. Well, we're going to come back to that. More on summer reading for kids and teens after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm KJ Dell'Antonia, in for Laura Knoy. Today, summer reading for kids. How can we encourage our kids to choose books when they have so many other options? Send us an email, join the conversation, exchange@nhpr.org, or respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. The Exchange phone number is 1-800-892-6477. All right. Oh, and our guests, let me remind you, our guests are Michael Sullivan, the library director at the Ware Public Library, Erin Moulton, young adult librarian at the Derry Public Library, and Elizabeth Ellis, who is starting as the librarian at the Timberlane Middle School in fall 2018. All right, we were talking about that difficult line between bribery and forcing kids to read. Elizabeth, you were saying that it's 3% of their grade when they come back to school, what they manage to read over the summer.
Yes, it is.
It just is.
It just is. I think what they came up with this summer was good because it is choice. They're not saying you have to read this book, and there's lots of options for them to show that they've read the book.
Right.
So the rubric isn't that difficult. If you show effort, you pass.
You're going to get your 3%. All right.
Right.
Well, so, Michael, you were saying that the Derry Library, you're the Ware Library. The Ware Library does have an incentive program.
Oh, yes. And every year we try and change it up a bit just to keep it kind of fresh. This year, what we've gone to is we have small prizes every week if you can meet three challenges. And the first challenge is always, did you read five times this week? And we have our calendar, and there's a checkbox. And every day that you sit down and read, you check it off. Five checks a week, you get your first check for the week. The second one is to do a library program. And this is something that I think is really important, and that is to build an environment that sparks kids' imagination, their intellect, their interest level. It's not just reading because I've worked in some very, very poor communities outside of the state. New Hampshire, we're really lucky that our kids exist in a world where there's a lot of intellectual stimuli. That isn't always the case. You need to take really big advantage of that. So the second checkbox is always, did you come to a library program? Gives them some way to expand. And then we do something fun like, did you learn how to stand on your head this week? And then they get a prize every week, 5 weeks running.
Erin, is this similar? I mean, you told us a little bit about your incentive program, but it sounds like it's pretty similar.
Yeah, we do a bingo sheet, but we also do library programs as well because we want the library to be in some. We basically in the summer, I think I want something for everyone. So we have make programs. We have escape rooms that I love creating.
Mm-hmm.
They totally got it really quickly last time, so I have to make this one harder. I always get a slightly different group. I'm going to stump them next time. today we have graffiti art. I do a scavenger hunt that's library-wide, and they have to go all around and like do ciphers and codes. And we have cupcake wars, writer's group, world music and food, and it's all based around the library's rock theme. And that just makes the library an inviting place for a lot of different people. I've noticed, especially with my escape room, which I've started doing this past year, is I get kids I've never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great because then I get to, interface
right.
with them and maybe have them come to the library more, read some more books, and join other programs.
Well, I think that's one of the challenges that both libraries and parents face is that there are so many other options for kids besides right. picking up a book. So, you can offer an incentive or a bribe or whatever you call it, but can you compete with Fortnite?
Yeah. And if you don't acknowledge that, if you just say, oh, no, that's just kids today just can't concentrate, you've lost. And it's really not true. I joke that my library, we play low-tech Guitar Hero
yep.
every week.
Yep.
It's because we have a beginner guitar class
right.
every week, and we've got 10-year-olds and they're learning the guitar, and yeah, they have the concentration to do it.
I think a lot of parents sort of face this question of, well, if I leave the reading up to the incentive from the school or the incentives from the library, some of my kids are just they're just not gonna it's not gonna work. I mean, a GameStop card is great, but it's not going to happen. So how can parents like create an environment where kids are more inclined to pick up a book, even if it's not their first choice?
Go ahead, Michael.
Oh, I was gonna say, because I got my big punchline on this one.
Go ahead.
Sorry. And it's really simple. They can start by reading themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the biggest problem, kids are hypersensitive to hypocrisy. They'll see it even when it's not there. Don't ever tell a kid that reading is important if they don't see you do it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I was going to say the exact same thing. You need to model the behavior a little bit at home. If you want them to find value in it, you have to value it as well.
But if I'm reading on my phone, I just look like I look all the time.
I know.
Yeah. Oh, you're showing me. Michael's showing me how to show them that I'm reading.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here.
Turn
reading
the phone around.
My phone.
Show them.
Or
better yet, read it out loud.
Right. Read it out loud or share if you read a book together, you know. Not necessarily sitting by side, but hey, let's read this month and then talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, reading aloud, you can do read aloud forever with novels. I mean, I remember being read aloud to my side of the mountain and just tons of books by my mom as we grew older and older, and it was great.
Yeah.
So
my fourth grade teacher. Sorry, as I'm getting the right one here. My fourth grade teacher, the last hour of every Friday, would read us the Little House on the Prairie series.
Mm-hmm.
I was a fourth grade boy growing up in, you know, the land of the woods, and the
right.
I had no interest whatsoever in Little House on the Prairie. And I still remember that. It's one of the most positive experiences I had in school.
Right. Yeah. I had a similar teacher who read during lunchtime, he read aloud to us the Brian Jake series, and I loved that. And then he really instilled reading. He also did, I think, 45 minutes to an hour at the end of the day of sustained silent reading. That was my favorite part of the day.
Well, so modeling and, you know, and doing it and discussing it is probably great, but only up to a point. I just feel like there are some kids that are always going to choose Snapchat or an unboxing video, no matter what they see you doing. So, Elizabeth, do you have any other ideas for just encouraging kids who are, You've had this kid for 8, 9, 10 years. He's not voluntarily picked up a book yet.
Maybe exchanging time. You have, you know, mm-hmm. if you play this video game for half an hour, then you're going to read for half an hour. So do the trade-off there with them. Also, other options are audiobooks. If you're on a vacation and you're going on a long trip, pick up some audiobooks at the library. Or they also have playaways for kids or adults also. That all you need is a pair of headphones, and it plugs into this little device you wear around your neck, and the book is right there with you.
Oh, I haven't seen that. That sounds neat. That's actually a question I've often wondered. Do schools – I'm going to turn this to you, Elizabeth. Do schools count audiobooks? Does that count?
Yes, we do. And we – are when a child – a student checks out a playaway book, they also get the actual book themselves, so they can be reading along as they're hearing it. And we have a large playaway selection and audiobook selection at our school.
Darren, do you think that – does it count for your checklist at the library?
Yeah, I wouldn't. So I try to make it as easy as possible for them to feel good about their reading. So if they said, well, I actually listened to this on audiobook, I'd be like, that's fine. I will check this off for you.
How about other formats? Does it matter if a kid is – and I know you're going to count this towards reading, but do we care if a kid is reading in print or on their laptop or on their phone or the Kindle?
The research says there's really no difference. And the research actually backs up the audiobook thing as well. The only thing that you don't get from listening to a book as opposed to reading it is spelling. And, spelling's – important, but I'm not going to discourage a kid from reading just because of that. But vocabulary, sentence structure, narrative, they get just as much out of that listening as they do reading. And for kids that don't read well, listening to audiobooks read out loud, just like listening to somebody reading a book out loud, will give them more language because the person reading to them is more fluent than they are themselves.
Mm. Right. So I was thinking about kids who are still decoding, basically. Hearing the book is as helpful for their, I guess, decoding learning as the actual sitting and decoding?
That's what 20 years of research is telling us.
Oh, that's fantastic. I've seen other research, though, that suggests, and I think a lot of parents might find this surprising, kids prefer to read on paper. They like, just like a lot of us do, they like the smell, they like the texture, and maybe they like the fact that their text notifications aren't going to drop down onto the page while they're reading, which I, the minute books start actually doing that, I think I'm just checking out. That'll be horrible. Do you see, I guess, do your libraries offer e-books?
We do, yeah.
You
we
do?
We do offer ebooks, but I've got to say it's mostly for adults. There aren't as there's just not as much of a base among the young adults and the children's. I definitely think there's a certain tactile pleasure to reading a book, and to do a long form reading, especially today when we have so much coming at us all the time, it's sometimes just nice to put a device away, just set it aside, make sure it's not there, and it's like your special time with just you and the book. So I definitely think there's something special about that.
And a lot of what Aaron's saying here this morning comes back to the importance of emotional attachment. And we discount this way too easily in this hurried up world. But what your emotions are tied into, you will learn better, you will retain better. And so that physical, you know, attraction to a book, the smell, certainly the experience of reading with somebody that you care about, that you know, means that you will pick up the language quicker and you will be more effective.
Right.
Well, let's talk about, I guess, what the kids are reading in general. So how much should we talked about how boys like to read, or not, I don't want to be boys. Really specific. Some kids like to read, you know, Ripley's Believe It or Not, which is a little bit, That's some weird stuff,
and
right?
That's part of its attraction.
Yeah, I think
the
so.
Fact that it drives parents crazy, that's the point.
Well, so we're talking about forms. How about graphic novels? How do we feel about that?
Does
that count? It's just a comic
I love
book.
Them. No, oh my gosh. It's a medium. So graphic novels, they can do anything. It's just a medium. They go over every genre. We've got great nonfiction graphic novels. We've got great historical fiction graphic novels. We've got silly, funny, awkward books. You know, it's everywhere. It's all over the board. And then you've got your superhero stuff. I think a lot of the times parents think that's a comic book. Whenever I say, hey, look, you could pick something from the graphic novel section, it's often a parent will say, wait a minute, I don't want you just reading comics. But if you look at the collection and you see what's really there, there is so much depth in the graphic novel collection.
Well,
so much depth.
Why do you think, Elizabeth, Michael, whichever of you has a thought on this, but Wrinkle in Time, the book, Wrinkle in Time, the graphic novel. Should we have any sort of feelings about which way our kids go?
What kids like, they're going to gravitate towards. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mentioned earlier the Dark Tower series, the Stephen King book that is so popular among young teens. Let's be honest, you know, we're not talking about just 18 to 30 year olds here. We're talking about 10, 11, 12 year olds who love the Dark Tower series. Having the graphic novel allows them to engage with it a little bit easier because it's easier to read the pictures when your language skills aren't up there. I'm all for them. In fact, I was reading Cage of Eden last night. That was what I was doing when my eyes were starting to drop. That's what's on my bedside table right now.
Elizabeth, are the graphic novels a success at the middle school
or
in the classroom?
Definitely.
And how do the teachers feel about them?
No, they're fine with them. And I think sometimes the kids will either read they will have read the novel first and then they'll go back and they'll read the graphic novel or start with the graphic novel and then read the novel.
Well, we skewed off a little bit into talking about Stephen King, and that did make me wonder, like, when are our kids ready for their first Stephen King? Or I mean, how much should we worry about a 10-year-old coming home with Twilight or any of that sort of thing? Should we be monitoring our kids, what they're reading? I'm just going to throw this to you, Elizabeth.
I just remember my mother. I brought a book home and when I was in junior high school, and she was like, nope.
Come on, tell us what it was.
I can't even remember the name of it.
And Judith Kranz, Jilly Cooper.
No, I can't even remember it. I just remember it sitting on her bookcase, and I could see it all the time. And then by the time I was old enough to read it, I really didn't have any interest in it.
What do you think, Erin? Do you do anything at the library?
I don't. No. As a librarian, we are not a parent, so we do not do any sort of helping. We can give recommendations, but we certainly wouldn't say, you can't take that. That's not our position. So I'm thinking, before we began, I was saying, yeah, I read it in sixth grade. Mm-hmm. I was pretty much unfettered. My mom and dad were just like, you have free rein to read whatever you want. And I loved reading because of that. So I think the more choice, the better. I think you can worry.
Right.
You can certainly worry.
And maybe talk about it if you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Engage
in the conversation. And even if you want, if you think that's definitely not an appropriate read for them, you could say, I'll read it first or we'll read it together. That might totally freak them out, possibly, away from reading it.
Don't we think that part of the appeal of reading a book with like a sex scene is that you can see it without your helpful mother or father leaning over your shoulder? It's so much better than, say, watching it on a screen, right?
And, of course, kids are evolving in their understanding of the world, and to whatever degree, every kid has a different threshold on this, but they need to, if they're an externalist thinker, they need to engage with the world to understand it. They can read a sex scene and understand sex without actually having to do it. And
right.
I think most of us would prefer that.
Yeah. Yes, right. That is an excellent
Same
point.
Thing with violence. When I was in Greenland, I had a fifth grade teacher. Every time there was a school shooting, she'd call me up and say, Mike, come do some book talking. And I knew what it meant. And that meant I would come in. She'd leave the room. Deniability. I would book talk for 30 minutes and finish up with Give a Boy a Gun by Todd Strasser. Because some kids needed to understand what was going on around them. The key is to engage with them. And the kid that I gave that book to, the deal was, you get to read it first, but when you're done, you have to bring it back and tell me what you thought of it.
Right. I was just thinking about, Jennifer Weiner's article in the New York Times, where she pointed out that reading romance for boys, like, romance with sex scenes might be like the best way to sort of counteract any porn that they've been watching. It's possible because at least it's a better approach. I don't know if we could get the boys to do that. Maybe if you dog-eared the right pages.
Certainly. I mean, the real difference between the sort of standard boy and girl approach, again, very broad terms that none of us really like to use. But the differentiation is often the difference between how much character plays versus how much plot plays. And when you think about it, romance is kind of a nice down the middle use of both, because it's not just the characters and their approach to it. It's what they're actually doing. So you will find a lot of very interested boys, although, again, they go to the nonfiction. They're more likely to find that.
Not sure how much nonfiction there. I guess a memoir. I'm not trying to think about how much nonfiction there might be that went with some bedroom
about
scenes.
Sex and,
sex expectations. Okay. We have some good resources in the nonfiction section for sure.
Elizabeth, you were saying before we got started that the middle school they require parents to okay kids taking out YA books.
Right. They have to have a sheet signed. And so when they go to check the book out, we can tell whether they can.
Do you have a sense of how many parents sign the sheet?
I don't. I don't.
Well, we'll come back to this question. And I think we're going to start doing some book recommendations after the break. This is The Exchange. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Start spreading the news. We're giving away a trip to New York in a couple of days. If you've been looking to melt away those small town blues, get yourself entered to win a trip to the city so nice they named it twice. All you have to do is contribute to NHPR, your trusted source for state, national, and international news. We're giving away this trip on Saturday, so if you want to be a part of it, don't wait. Give today as generously as you can at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm KJ Delantonia, in for Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on the show, we'll have the weekly news roundup with host Peter Biello. This hour, we're talking about summer reading for kids. What books are your kids and teens excited about this summer? What do you recommend? And we're going to talk about what we recommend. If you have ideas, send them by email to exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. And our guests in the studio are Michael Sullivan, author of Connecting Boys with Books and Raising Boy Readers, Aaron Moulton, author of the YA novels Flutter, Tracing Stars, Chasing the Milky Way, and Keepers of the Labyrinth, and Elizabeth Ellis, who is a former language arts teacher and soon to be the librarian at Timber Lane Middle School. I am going to start with an email from a listener. This is from Angie. She says, as a child, I chewed through books. I'd read a 300-page novel in 3 days. I was in third grade doing book reports on Clive Cussler and Dean Koontz novels. In fifth grade, I read Nelson DeMille's The General's Daughter, after which my parents tried screening my books, but they couldn't keep up with me. Can you recommend some writers or series for advanced readers that have advanced vocabulary but not advanced themes? So it's a perfect question to segue us into this. She just said advanced readers, so I guess let's consider the reader who's, you know, third or fourth grade, so maybe the 9 or 10 year old, but who's capable of reading on an adult level, but maybe you don't really want to hand them those adult books yet.
Okay. To fantasy for those.
That's what I was thinking too. Yeah.
Jonathan Stroud is one of the greats, and his stuff is accessible to, you know, all sorts of emotional levels, but his writing style is incredibly in depth and just beautifully done. So Jonathan Stroud did the Bartimaeus trilogy, mm-hmm. Screaming Staircase, the Lockwood and Company series. And those kind of readers, ones that chew through, get them in a big, long series, because once they get started, you have the next 15 books lined up.
And I think for those who don't like fantasy, mysteries, right?
Mysteries are great, yeah.
They don't tip, well, it depends on how dark you go, but the cozies, they don't have very many adult themes. Erin's looking dubious. She's thinking.
Thinking.
Elizabeth, Annie, what do you do when one of the young middle schoolers comes in, you know, and you know that's a reader who can really take it, but maybe their parents haven't signed that form? I guess you haven't been in this position yet. It's next year. You're going to be ready. Well, you're going to go with fantasy. we're coming up with offers for you.
The Brian Jake series has always been great for the upper middle grade kids. There's also some great contemporary novels that, they touch on really intense themes, but they aren't, and they're not particularly easy reading, but they're great literary work. So things like Three Times Lucky is a great, you know, anything that hits the Newbery list, those are great quality books. Bud Not Buddy is wonderful. They have a lot of heart and literary value, but they're not touching on any intense themes that you'd find in YA at all.
A lot of our listeners are really wanting to hear some names of graphic novels. Michael says, you don't seem to understand how intimidating a book or novel is to someone who has never read one. Short stories, articles in magazines, sure. Graphic novels help us build some confidence. And Sandra from Manchester says, yes to kids reading graphic novels.
Yes.
As a child in the 60s, I devoured the graphic novels of the day, my dad's collection of classics illustrated. It excited me with comic book style renditions of classics like Frankenstein, Jane Eyre, and The Last of the Mohicans. Many years later, as an adult, I started reading the actual classics. So yes, graphic novels are a gateway to literature and a lifetime of reading. Give us some top graphic novels.
My favorite ones recently have been the whole Paper Girls series. I'm loving that. It's all fun sci-fi. March, I really loved. That's John Lewis's autobiography written as a graphic novel. I just read, I think it could be considered a graphic novel, Alita Judge's Mary's Monster, and it follows Mary Shelley's journey just growing up and then creating Frankenstein. I don't know if it would be considered a graphic novel or an illustrated novel, but it certainly is within a category of, you know, enjoying that kind of classic.
Right.
There
are
with
those
pictures.
Books, kind of. Diary of the Wimpy Kid on a junior level and
sure.
Some of the others where there's a lot of pictures, but it's not exactly the graphic novel. I'm thinking of The Expeditioners by S.S. Taylor. She's right. A local author, and those are very much like that. Michael, what are you thinking of when I say graphic novels?
Well, the ones you were just talking about, the graphic mashups, the ones that are half graphic novel, half text, are fantastic. The one there, the real killer, is Monkey Me, Timothy Rowland's. If your kid's a Captain Underpants fan, that's the next series you've got to put in his hands, absolutely. I'm more towards the manga side because I'm a real series reader, and I think a lot of the—
Manga, that's Japanese animation.
Yep, and it's done in serial form, mm-hmm. so they often to be very long. And to Mike, the emailer there, that's really, if you're intimidated by books, manga is the way to go. Cage of Eden, I just mentioned, is a real big favorite of mine. For the younger kids, Boy and Beast is very accessible mm-hmm. to kids really as young as third and fourth grade. I hand it to my fourth graders all the time. For the ones that just eat it up, Habibi.
Oh, yeah.
Craig Thompson. Yeah. It's the most stunning work of graphic novel I've seen yet.
And some fun middle grade ones are also Svetlana Chimakova's books, Awkward. And I think most recent one is Brave, right?
Is
it's so fun.
And
so
then
fun.
There's Sisters, Drama, mm-hmm. and Ghosts.
I'm glad you brought those up. My girls love, all my kids, not just my girls. They all have loved those.
El Defo.
Yes.
Roller Girl.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sunny Side Up. Swing It Sunny. Middle school kids love those.
I'm writing down the two of those that we don't already have. We're going to take a call from Stillwater in Boscawen. Stillwater, thanks for calling.
Well, you're quite welcome. Thanks for having me.
What do you have to say about reading with kids and teens in the summer?
Well, there's a few things. One is, in order to get kids to read, you have to read to them. You start out at a very young age. We've had two boys. And since day one, they've been read to every night. It's anywhere from 20 minutes to a half an hour to an hour. Literally every night.
Were there some books that found were particularly successful as read-alouds?
Well, I mean, just going back to the children's books, just the young ones, I don't have any specific titles other than, the normal one is Harry Potter.
Oh, that's a great one.
The Harry Potter series is great, but we limit screen time, too.
And how old are your kids now, Stillwater?
8 and 10.
And do they read themselves?
Our biggest problem is to keep the books out of their hands. they will spend an hour and a half in the bathroom, and they bring the books to the table. They get in trouble in school for sneaking mm-hmm. off and going to read. There's just so much that they do.
That is such a good problem to have.
It's a wonderful problem to have. But what we have, too, is we've got a situation with the Harry Potter movies and the Harry Potter books. Now, what we do is we'll read a book, and we'll all read it. The kids just go crazy with this stuff. But we read it, and then we watch the movie.
Sure.
And we go back and critique it. And the difference between the books, and there's so much in the books versus the movies, that the kids get excited about it. They want to be able to challenge the movie. Well, this wasn't in the movie, and this wasn't in the movie, and where's this character?
Right,
and I
think
get
that's
so excited about it.
That is that's a great way to approach reading and books that are going to turn into movies. Stillwater, thank you so much for calling. I'm going to turn that to you, Aaron. How do you feel about should the kid read the book first or the movie first? I'm really throwing you a softball there.
It's okay. I don't, I actually don't care either way.
Really?
No. I think I'm similar to our callers that I often notice there are very big differences between the book and the movie, and I often like the book better. But I think I love the idea of just creating that. It's almost like doing a movie book tie-in book club, but he's creating it at home and they're reading the book and then they're watching the movie, and it's a perfect way to engage with it. So there's so many now that you could use to do that sort of thing.
Elizabeth, at the middle school, do you guys do anything with sort of movies that have been made into books?
We did.
Or
this,
how about the other way around, too?
Well, we
did.
We read in one of my classes, we read Wonder.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not show the movie, but a lot of the kids, they saw the movie, and they would come back and say they liked the book better. There were so many things missing from the book that were not in the movie.
How about you, Michael? Books, movies. How about what about those books that are made? They're like made from the movie adapt.
Yeah,
so it's the Incredibles 2, the book.
Yeah. I like both forms of storytelling a lot, and I like the fact that, you know, people can watch both. I'm a Lord of the Rings. I'm going to wear my geek flag here. Lord of the Rings is my big thing, and I read the books, listen to the audio tapes, watch the movies, watch the animated versions. Mm-hmm. Any form of the story I love because they are so different. Which brings us to the novelizations, which tend to be really, really terrible because you're trying to make a book something that it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Just like anybody who tries to make a movie that is line for line from the book, you're going to have a pretty bad movie.
Right.
It's a different type of storytelling.
Right. Yeah.
And what really enthralls me is how they take the story in the different formats.
We're going to take another call. We have Paul from Dublin on the line. Paul, thank you for calling.
Hi. I'd just like to mention Alistair MacLean, who is overlooked, I think, as a wonderful way of getting into...
We lost Paul. Okay, all right. So, well, Alistair MacLean, a good way of getting into books for boys. I don't know Alistair MacLean.
Mystery writer from the 70s,
Oh,
right?
A little bit what I was saying about having kids read the cozies. That's
yeah, it's amazing how many
bias.
Boys skip children's writing altogether and go right to the adult shelves. Robert Parker, Stephen King,
James Patterson.
Yeah, because it's not that there isn't a lot of literature for them in the children's and teen sphere. It's just they don't see it very often, and they see the adult books as speaking right to them. So yeah, there's an awful lot those hardcore mystery kind of guys.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
little Ian Fleming too.
Oh yeah, always has been popular. Some of that stuff gets dated, and so there are going to be some kids that are react against it, but an awful lot of boys especially will just skip right into the adult books.
So we're hitting graphic novels, and we're kind of in the YA space. Can we go a little younger and talk some middle grade stuff? I'm getting smiles. Anybody got ideas? Oh, Elizabeth, some good middle grade reads.
I love Kwame Alexander,
mm-hmm.
The Crossover, great book.
Solo.
Booked. Rebound is his newest one.
And what kind of, who are those going to appeal to?
I think they appeal to the more struggling, developing readers, as well as the proficient readers. Because when somebody who doesn't read a lot looks at the page, there's not a lot of words on the page, so it's not intimidating to them. For that reason, books in verse, I think, are good. Forget Me Not is mm-hmm. another book in verse. House Arrest by K.A. Holt. Mm-hmm. And she also did Rhyme Schemer.
Yeah.
Inside Out and Back Again. So all those
We're going to put a list of those up on our website. And right now we have a call, and this is Eric from Laconia with a kind of an interesting thought. I hadn't thought of this. Eric, thanks for calling. What do you have to say?
One of the tactics that I found with my kids is I'm a younger parent, and I play a lot of video games. And my kids were always interested in, hey, Dad, what does that say? How did you know to do this? So what I did was I just went into the games marketplace and I found a couple of games that would require them to read in order to succeed at the game.
Mm-hmm.
One of them I can think of in particular is called Typo Man, which is where if you want the platform to go up, they give you a series of letters and you have to spell the word up. Or if there's a wall that needs to fall down, you have to make the word lever to create a lever to pull in order for it to drop. So it motivated them to learn how to read, to learn how to spell, so that they could actively participate in these games that they see all of their friends play.
That is really smart, and it seems like that you can't sort of randomly pick your letters and just achieve it in the game, which some of the games you can fool That sounds great. Well, thank you. Thanks for calling. Remember when all the video game was like words on the screen and you were like, yes, now I am going to the campfire.
Adventure. I remember those.
Yeah. It's not like that now. How about, so some kids really like to read, they like to read what they think of as a grown-up book. What are some crossover books where both adults and kids are reading them right now?
Nonfiction is always a good place to go for that. I think one of the great ones that I've been able to push for my teens is The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. It's a recent book. You know how many four-year-olds know everything there is to know about
this
dinosaurs?
This is true.
And then we give up on that joy and that fascination. So The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs has been really, really good. Scott Westerfield is a teen writer who a lot of adults think, why isn't he for us? Well, he's for you too. Zeros has been a great series that's come out, so he's
right.
A good place to go.
Well, we're about to the end of our hour, so let's do last book recommendation. The one I that you wanted to tell us about that I didn't give you a chance to. You got anything, Erin?
Yes, Hazelwood by Melissa Albert. It's a fairy tale, but it's incredibly dark. So it's for those who like their fairy tales grimmer than Grimm's.
Elizabeth.
Code of Honor by Alan Gratz. It's one of those that has the cliffhanger at the end of every chapter, so it makes you want to keep reading.
Ooh, yeah, that sounds really good. Michael, we got a minute?
How about a regional title? Small publishers often do some really great, interesting stuff. The Adirondack Kids from Gary Riper and his son. What's Gary's son's name? Justin. Gary and Justin Riper. Lots of animals, adventure, and dumb kid stunts in the woods.
Well, that sounds great. I'm going to add that there's a series my kids love, The Penderwicks. They have a new book, and we thought they were done. So that was pretty exciting, The Penderwicks at last. And that's our show. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm KJ Delantonia, in for Laura Canoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.